Yes, it is, and welcome back. As I was mentioning in the previous segment before the top of the hour break, Brandon J. Weikert was coming right up, and he is here. He is the author of Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower, a geopolitical analyst who publishes The Weikert Report, W-E-I-C-H-E-R-T, theweikertreport.com is the website. It's totally free, and it keeps you up to date on all that Brandon is up to. I hope you're well, sir. Brandon, welcome back.
How are you?
I'm doing just fine. But I was reading a report in the Wall Street Journal, Brandon, and you'll scold me for this. I was unaware, not of the goings on between Iran and the United States to strike a nuclear deal in Vienna as they're attempting. I was caught unawares at how much Iran is giving us the hand, how much they don't want to be directly negotiating with us, how much we are trying to entreat them to sit at the table and give us a deal. I didn't realize how much we were pushing for this and how little they seemed to be interested in it.
Well, that's right. Well, you can't be blamed for knowing because the media has done a very good job in the West of not reporting it.
Okay.
Everybody knows that Biden is going to give the store away to the Islamists in Iran. And the Islamists in Iran understand that as well. Remember what former President Trump said about negotiating with Persians, who are Iranians. He said they're tough. This goes back thousands of years. Iranian rulers have always been very good at playing hardball. They could have a horrible hand that they're playing, but they will bluff their way through. And this is part of Iran's game. And the Democrats, going back to Jimmy Carter, have a problem where they take the Iranians at face value. Khomeini bluffed his way into power. Under Barack Obama, Khomeini, the current Ayatollah, and at the time Rouhani, the former president of Iran, dubbed a moderate who wasn't, were very good at bluffing and bullying Obama to get him to give away the store with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. And Biden's doing the same thing. The Iranian leadership knows the deal is all but done. They know that Biden will do whatever he can to get a deal, and so they're going to squeeze him for all the change they can get out of him. Not only are they going to get their nuclear deal, but they're probably going to get a great trade deal. They're probably going to get all kinds of favorable status coming out of this. And also, by the way, Russia and China have their back as never before, because Biden's picking fights with Moscow and Beijing right now, and we're feeling the pressure. And the Iranians know that we are led by an idiot, and it's not going to end well for us.
I have to tell you, there must be volumes written, volumes, about the folly of engaging in negotiations where the stronger party is begging and cajoling the weaker party to come to a deal that they don't want to accept, and have us as the ones who are willing to open up the cupboards and give everything to them just so that we can get a deal. I have to believe that this is something that has been written about since before the Treaty of Westphalia.
Well, it has been. My forthcoming book, The Shadow War, Iran's Quest for Supremacy, if I can just plug my work here.
Yeah.
I'd say about 60% of the book is dedicated to taking the Democrats, because it's usually the Democrats, taking Jimmy Carter, Barack Obama, and Joe Biden to task for this sort of, any deal is a good deal approach to what is probably the most important geopolitical issue, certainly in the Middle East, today. And the Iranians know that they have a deal. They know that no matter what, they're walking out with a deal. So they're going to do whatever they can to squeeze us, and it's going to work because Biden wants out of the Middle East at all costs, no matter what it costs him, and he wants to be able to tell the American people, I have a deal, and I ended the wars in Iraq, and I ended the war around Iraq, but in Afghanistan. He doesn't care about the details, and the devil's in the details, of course. He just wants to be remembered as the guy who got a deal with Iran, even though it's going to let them have nuclear weapons. It's going to let them, basically, it's going to trigger an arms. It's going to start the very thing that Biden has been saying he wants to avoid, which is a nuclear arms race and another war. But Iran's going to think, coming out of Vienna, oh, we've got this thing. Let's let her rip. And the Saudis are then going to start their own nuclear weapons program. They're going to go at breakneck speed. The Israelis have already gone off on Joe Biden this morning and yesterday. And so Israel's going to probably take some decisive, drastic action to keep us involved, even if it means initiating a war. So all the things that Biden's supposedly trying to avoid by doing this deal with Iran, he's actually precipitating the very event that he's supposedly going to be avoiding with this deal, which is a major Middle Eastern war, which sucks in the great powers, the United States, Russia, and China, and probably triggers a nuclear world war, which is what I'm worried we're heading toward very quickly right now.
See, it seems to me, thank you for that analysis, Brandon, it seems to me that when it comes to international diplomacy, you want the weaker party. You want them coming to you. You want them begging you. You want them entreating you. I remember during the Soviet Union's last days or last decade in 1984, so the end of Reagan's first term, was winding down, and George Shultz was then the Secretary of State testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, chaired by one Paul Tsongas of Massachusetts, Democrat. And I remember Paul Tsongas saying to Secretary Shultz, do you realize you'll be the first administration since World War II that hasn't had face-to-face meetings with the Soviet Union? And God bless George Shultz. Do you know what he said, Brandon? He said three words. He said, so be it. So be it. It seems to me that it's the regime that has the most to lose that begs for these kinds of things. And boy, I got to tell you, as between Iran and the United States, I didn't think we were the one who had the most to lose.
Well, Joe Biden and the Democrats have the most.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Joe Biden and the Democrats have the most. And that's the key. So
it's a political battle. You know, it's a political battle in what you're discussing, that they want a political victory for this. The funny thing is, of all his promises Joe Biden made to turn around everything, to turn upside down, or you know, reverse everything Trump did, I don't get a large sense, or even a small sense, from the largeness of the American people that this is what they're clamoring for. I spent a lot of time in social situations, Brandon. You probably do, too. When's the last time anyone went up to you and said, boy, I wish Joe Biden would fulfill that promise on a nuclear deal with Iran? I have never heard that sentence.
Well, the Democrats that I know think this needs to happen.
Okay.
And so they're all excited. They think that this is a good thing. They think the Republicans are crazy. They think that we're warmongers because we haven't done this before. So the Democrats that I know, and I know a lot of Democrats, they think this is brilliant. Give it a chance. Give peace a chance. And so that's where the left is. There's no consensus on this issue among the left and the right in America, or in the West in general. And, you know, it's going to set us up for a really rude awakening when Iran reveals they've got these nukes and they're going to start deploying them. And even without nukes, they're already going out and being offensive in the Middle East. Once the nukes are allowed to be gotten openly by Iran under this deal, Saudi Arabia is then going to do a breakout thing. Then the Israelis are going to start doing it. This is going to do everything that we don't want to happen in the Middle East. It's going to happen. And about the whole thing about not meeting with Iran, you know, a deal would be nice, a real deal. But as Reagan said when he was running for office in 1980, they asked him, they said, said, hey, why are you so against building bridges to the Soviet Union? Reagan looked at the interviewer and he said, I'm all for building bridges, but when you build a bridge, you have to start at both sides and meet in the middle. And I'm not going to be the one doing all the work to meet the Soviets and not get what we need out of it. And that's the same thing it should be with Iran. That's the exact same logic. Yeah, we'll build bridges, but they got to meet us middle way, and we've got to be able to walk away with a real deal. The Iranians don't want a deal. They want the nukes at all costs, and that's the fact.
Brandon Weichert is our guest. We have to take a quick break. He's happy to take your questions, too, 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Brandon J. Weichert is our guest, foreign policy expert, but also domestic politics as well, and political philosophy, just for an added extra measure of intelligence. He is the publisher of the Weichert Report. Also, we often refer to his book from last year, Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower. I think it's fair to say that Brandon and I are both Claremont Institute adjacent, if not closer. We like the Claremont Institute and a lot of the folks there. They lost a foreign policy scholar recently, Angelo Codevilla, Codevilla. He died too soon. I was reading some tributes to him, and the common theme is that we lost him just when we needed him most, just as the world was getting crazier and crazier, including the vacuum of leadership in the United States. I thought I'd run by Brandon, who knew him a little bit, too, if he might just say a word. We praise good people here, Brandon, and say something about intelligence, foreign policy, and the loss of this great scholar, Angelo Codevilla.
Well, Angelo was larger than life. Now, I want to make it clear to your audience, I knew him a little bit. I didn't know him the way the people at Claremont did. I didn't know him the way that our friend Julie Ponzi did, or even my publisher, Al Regnery, who has known him for 30 years. But he and I had interacted a little bit before last year at some Claremont events in D.C. We had a lot of similar friends, people that we knew in our social circle. He was familiar with me. I was a fan of his work, and he liked some of my work. Of course, he told me what he liked and didn't like. But he was just a larger-than-life figure. He served this country. He came, if you know, the obituary in the American Mind, the obituary for him in the Claremont Review of Books really gives you this very full picture of a man born into nothing who came from war-torn Italy in 43, came to the United States with nothing on his back, and fought and worked hard and became one of the top intellectuals in national security policy at a very young age. And he, you know, even you agree or disagree, this guy was a force of nature. He was brilliant. He was funny. He was tough. He was a tough old bird. But he knew his stuff, and he was somebody that the movement and our country, in my opinion, was better with rather than without. And unfortunately, he was taken. Now, he was an old man, but he was killed in an unfortunate accident and taken too soon in many ways, because he was really flowering as a writer and getting much greater public notoriety in the last probably 5 to 7 years than he had before. He wrote some wonderful books, though. I knew him as a missile defense expert.
He really wrote one of the first books on moral justification of missile defense.
Yep, that's exactly right. Yeah. It was always with him, not just the national interest, but there was a moral component, and he was very articulate about that. And I got to know him beyond just the social interaction because I sent him the manuscript for my book, Winning Space. My publisher, Al Regnery, was very good friends with Angelo, and he thought it would be good to get us together. And Angelo, in the last year of his life, gave his time for nothing. I mean, I wasn't getting paid. We didn't really know each other all too well. But he spent a good 6 months reviewing my manuscript, and telling me what was wrong with it and telling me what was right. And, and giving of his time, which when you're that age and you've got other things going on, that really meant the world to me.
I bet.
And I really appreciate it, because there's a section in the book on China's laser program to create these anti-satellite weapons that he really helped me and guided me with some of the research. And I feel very honored that he gave even the short amount of time that he did. And it was mostly through email because it was during COVID.
Sure.
He's a really wonderful person and a real, real fierce intellect. And even when I disagreed with him, and there were things that I'm not going to recount what they are, there are things that we disagreed on, but I always got something out of the exchanges with him in terms of, you know, intellectual and personal, positive sort of thing that I got from him. And obviously he enjoyed our interactions enough to give his time the way he did to this project. It's just sad that he went when he did, because really he was giving voice to a lot of issues in a very articulate way, in a very unique way, that very few of us could have done. And his years and decades in government, working in the national security space, having that clearance level that he did, he was able to have a lot of influence over the course of the United States. And the places that he didn't have influence, were things that did not go well for the country.
Yeah, I was going to say failures, yeah.
You want to talk about having an impact. This guy, probably many of your audience, they might be familiar with him because he was getting published in American Greatness. That was a very widely read magazine. But before that, many in your audience might never have heard of him. But he was really just brilliant, and he really had a lot of influence. You know, he had reach everywhere. A lot of things were influenced and impacted by him and his writing and his thought. And like I said, where he didn't have an impact, the country suffered, really.
For those that want to learn more, let me recommend the latest issue of the Claremont Review of Books, which has a series of tributes to him. You're kind of like me in this sense, Brandon, that we were fortunate enough to attend schools with some great and prominent and influential professors, but then again, also schools that didn't have other great and prominent and wonderful professors that we got to know separately in our professional lives. And I've often used the construction about some of them myself. Probably you're one of the few people that can do this as well, or likes to. You can appreciate this maybe. I often describe them as the best teachers I never had.
Yeah.
I think of someone like Robert George at Princeton like that, or Hadley Arkus at Amherst, I think of like that. The best teachers I never had. Angelo could be maybe one of those for you, huh?
Yes. I never, I wasn't a Claremont fellow, not yet. Maybe one day, if they'll have me, I don't know. So I didn't get to know him in that setting. But like I said, initially, I was living in D.C., and Claremont had events out there, and so I would go and interact with these people that I looked up to. I won't say this story.
That's all right.
But, Angelo was a very gregarious guy in certain settings, and that's how I initially knew him, was just sort of as this, person I had revered reading all of his work, and then had the fortune to transition into a more professional, direct professional, and maybe even personal relationship in the last year. So, he's the great professor I never had in class, but learned so much from.
Well, you can follow my path on this. I'm a little older than you, Brandon. If it makes any difference, you're always where you're supposed to be. I got turned down for my first application for a Claremont Fellowship. I got it the second time around. If I can get there, you can. We'll be right back. I want to touch on Russia and China with Brandon when we come back. We will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Brandon J. Weikert is our guest. He's the publisher of the Weikert Report. I have said any number of times the survival of the United States militarily and as a force for good, physically even, will happen to the degree that Brandon Weikert and his recommendations are accepted. I've done a deep dive into his work on this stuff. I have easily concluded that. I've also said, if you want to know the news a month before it breaks, listen to my interviews with Brandon. November 28th, which would be yesterday, Brandon, the New York Times writes this, and I heard you talking about this on the show months ago, has to do with nuclear arms race in China. And it says, Mr. Biden's aides, I'm quoting directly, are driven by concerns that a new arms race is heating up over hypersonic weapons, space arms, and cyber weapons, all of which could unleash a costly and destabilizing spiral of move and countermove. The fear is that an attack that blinded space satellites or command and control systems could quickly escalate. China's capabilities can also pose a threat to President Biden's hopes for reducing the role of nuclear weapons in America's defenses. Why? One might ask, because China is looking to build somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 more warheads. And it's not just the number of weapons, as they point out, it's the technology. You've been talking about this, really, I mean, on this show for months, before that for years. Brandon, I remember when the United States wanted to build nuclear weapons, people from Europe to the United States marched in protest wearing skeletons and gas masks. I presume no one's marching over the 1,500 warheads China wants to build.
Oh, no. No, no, no. If you do that in China, you get killed.
Yep.
You know, and let's face it.
And if you do it in Germany, they won't, because they don't care. It's only when the U.S. builds weapons that they care about.
Right.
Okay, understood.
Right. You know, the useful idiots on the American left will not brook American greatness. They want us to always be on the lookout and afraid and second or even third to other more aggressive powers because, you know, we're imperialists or we have a history of evil or whatever, you know. That's the bottom line, is on some level these people on the left, and we now are being led by them, they hate America as it is. And they want to see America diminished because it's just not fair, or whatever. And so they don't, you know, they don't want to see us. Let's just look at it this way: we could have had real, clean, limitless, abundant energy in this country 50 years ago with nuclear power, and it was the left who killed it.
Mm-hmm.
And now today, I'm reading, and I've talked to you about this for months as well, and I wrote about this in my book. China is leading the world, not just in nuclear reactor construction, but now they are leading the world in nuclear fusion development, something that the left has always panned. I remember Obama, one of the senior Obama former Department of Energy people, going on Morning Joe about 2 years ago, renouncing his previous support for nuclear fusion and traditional nuclear fission, saying that it was too dangerous. Well, China's got the hottest burning nuclear fusion tokamak reactor. And by the way, China announced that within the next year, they will be putting dozens of nuclear reactors in space to power future space missions, which technically is an act of war, because those nuclear reactors could easily be turned into nuclear bombs and dropped on us from orbit. But has the Pentagon or has the Biden administration said anything? No. No. Has the media asked any questions? No. No, of course not.
Well, this is because what the U.S. has done is drawn what you wrote in an op-ed in the Dallas Morning News is a Maginot line, which I'm not sure people know what that means anymore, but it was supposedly France's deterrence against Germany, right?
Right, right. It was the shield behind which France could hide and would not need to be so focused on war after the First World War.
Let me pause you there. This is a big one, and we're going to teach some people some stuff here. Let me hit the commercial break. Let's pick up on all this in relationship to your op-ed on America's Maginot Line in space. Can we do that real quick when we come back?
I'd love to,
I'm Seth. He's Brandon. We will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Little Glenn Campbell for you. Brandon J. Weikert is our guest. He is the publisher of the Weikert Report, theweikertreport.com, free website that doesn't invade you with all kinds of pop-ups and things that you have to try and find X's to. He's also the author of Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower, his book on Iran coming out next year. But your column on the Maginot Line in space, Brandon, remind people of what the Maginot Line is and why you're talking about America's Maginot Line. Yeah.
Of course. Well, basically, after the First World War, the French were convinced that the Germans were not going to stop being a threat, even though they had defeated the Germans with our help. But the French also were war-weary, and so they wanted to find this kind of perfect solution where they could defend adequately their country from another German invasion while at the same time not having to commit the whole country to a war footing. And so they came up with, and actually, contrary to what many people think, the Maginot Line was actually very sophisticated engineering. It was a series of interconnected concrete bunkers and steel-reinforced facilities that basically divided their border from Germany. And it was manned by French troops with great weapons. And basically it was designed to be an unbreakable barrier again that the potential German invasion would hit and completely dissolve and be defeated without ever stepping foot on French territory. They basically in France took all of the experiences and all of the lessons learned from the First World War and applied it in this development of the Maginot Line, because they assumed another war with Germany would be just like the First World War, where it would be this sort of static battle of trench warfare, germ warfare, bioweapons. And so this wall was designed to mitigate that significantly. And had the Second World War been identical to the First World War, it is likely that with the Maginot Line, France would have been spared the German onslaught. Unfortunately for the French, losing can be a teacher all of its own, and the Germans lost badly in the First World War, and they applied their own lessons, and they said, you know, we're not going to do the static war of attrition. We're going to embrace the airplane. We're going to embrace armor, tanks and armored vehicles, and we're going to outmaneuver. We're going to embrace the maneuver warfare, the Blitzkrieg, the Lightning War. And so rather than going at France, they said, aha, the Maginot Line stops at France's border with Belgium. And the French didn't build near Belgium because of the Ardennes Forest. And they figured, well, no human force could get through the Ardennes. The Germans tried previously, and that's what got them bogged down. So they won't be able to do it again. Well, with the tank and the airplane and the armored personnel carrier, the Germans, the Nazis, were able to do just that. They completely outmaneuvered this expensive, beautiful, Maginot Line and punched into Paris and then circled back after taking the capital in France and pushing the British out into sea. They then circled back and basically, locked all the French soldiers that were manning the wall in the barricades. They basically turned that defensive perimeter into a prisoner of war camp. And that was a record victory for any country against a major power like France. And the Maginot Line was completely ineffectual, did nothing.
The most important lines, or at least the ones I found most important in your op-ed, may I read them to you?
Please.
America's national
defense.
Oh, good, good, good. America's national defense is predicated upon the lessons learned from the previous century of conflict. Yet, in an age of radical and exotic military technologies, where the United States is no longer the only technological dominant state, America is not well defended. As the United States continues behaving as though its national defenses are impenetrable, China continues expanding its capabilities to threaten
right.
America, I might add, and show that they are indeed penetrable.
Right. Right. And that's my concern, is our air defense network. You and I have spoken about this
yep.
before. Our air defense network is primed for defending against a Soviet-style ICBM nuclear missile attack. They are not primed against defending the country from an omnidirectional Chinese hypersonics missile attack that could come, as it says, from any direction, that could completely evade detection because our air defense systems are only tracking mostly west to east, east to west, not north-south, yep. south-north.
Mm-hmm.
And the vehicle in question is moving so fast, minimum of 3,800 miles an hour, that it can be deployed into orbit and orbit the Earth for months, maybe even years, before actually coming down over their target. It's almost impossible to defend against, not without space-based defenses, which is something that gets us back to Angelo Codevilla, who was one of the early proponents of space-based missile defense. And it never, if you'll pardon the expression, got off the ground because of those peaceniks on the left who said you can't weaponize space. Well, guess what, buddies? Angelo and Reagan were right. We should have had, and Brian Kennedy as well, we should have had space-based defenses decades ago. And if we had them, the hypersonic missile threat wouldn't be non-existent because we would be able to have greater situational awareness and the ability to intercept those hypersonic missiles in space before they ever got near their targets on Earth. But because we didn't do this, because we're coming 30 years behind, China is ahead of us. And our own hypersonic weapon systems that we're trying to build have been mired in development hell for the last three decades, because they're not properly resourced, they're not led by the right kinds of leaders, either in the military or in the civilian side. And the most recent test that they did a few weeks ago of our system was a disaster. It was a joke. And meanwhile, China has working versions. They're building even more advanced, bigger, more lethal versions in the real world. It's not just on the computer anymore that they're simulating it. They're actually deploying these systems in the real world and testing them. And so the Chinese are ahead of us in so many ways. And our systems of defense for the homeland, I'm not even talking about bases overseas or our ships, I'm talking about the homeland, are so inadequate and antiquated compared to this threat that it's only a matter of time before China says the Americans are weak and vulnerable. They're not going to let us have Taiwan peacefully, so we're going to have to punch them in the nose to send them stumbling back. And we're going to do that by attacking them in space with anti-satellite weapons and attacking them on the home front with these hypersonic weapons. And that is exactly what's going to happen, I fear, very soon.
You made an interesting historical point, Brandon. I'll let you go on this one for consideration. Maybe we address it in a bit next week. But
yeah.
I came of political acuity in the 70s and 80s, and I remember an awful lot of no nukes marches. I remember an awful lot of talk about the non-proliferation treaty. From Western Europe to here, protests en masse, huge numbers of protests, not one against the Soviet Union, and not one then or now against China, only against America. Isn't that telling? I'll leave it there. We'll pick it up next week. Brandon Weikert, Godspeed and God bless.
Thank you, sir.
Talk to you next week. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Rob, in surprise, I hope you had a great Thanksgiving, sir. How are you?
I am fine. I did have a fine Thanksgiving, and I didn't even have to cook, which makes it even better, and I hope you did too, sir.
Well, it made it better because I did cook. It made it better because I did. Yeah, I hate to say it, but it turns out I'm a pretty good cook.
Well, it turns out I am too. We may have to have a cook.
Yeah, we may have to. We may have to.
Yeah, you know, get on Beat Bobby Flay or something.
Yeah. Or we can just have a, well, what we would call a non-station event, just so that Jim Ryan doesn't get upset. But we may have to do that.
Well,
yeah.
That's fine, too.
Okay.
I was interested in listening to Brandon, and again, there's very little I can disagree with him on, and I have the same sort of fear that he has. And again, I think, you know, I'm reminded about Winston Churchill's While England Slept. I'm reminded also about JFK actually wrote a book while he was still at Harvard, I think, called Why England Slept.
Yep.
And then there was an article a couple of weeks ago that was on some website, I can't even recall, and it says while America is sleeping.
Yeah.
And it's sort of all tied together. That
oh, it is. Our effort is that
guys are doing.
Yeah, our effort is to prevent a book called While America Slept. We don't want that book written.
No, at least unless we can find an American Churchill of some sort, but that would have to be, that would have to change the entire education system. So anyway, I was going through what I think is a mandatory book for all conservatives, which is Barry Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative. And yes, he had written it, back during, 1960-ish when the Soviet menace was there. And, he mentions about how our freedom has always depended, to a great extent on what's happening beyond our shores.
Mm-hmm.
And, there was a chapter 10 that talks about the Soviet menace. And I think you could just exchange, the word Soviet, with the Chinese. Because there's things in this chapter that he talks about. Our enemies have understood the nature of this conflict, and we have not. They're determined to win the conflict, and we are not.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of says it all. And then, if an enemy power is bent on conquering you and proposes to turn all of its resources to that end, he's at war with you.
Yeah.
And you, unless you contemplate surrender, are at war with him, whether you like it or not. And I think what the problem is in D.C. is that our leaders have not made victory, this is in Goldwater's words, the goal of American policy. And that they've never, and many of the people in Washington never believed deeply that the communists, well, that's China.
You've hit on something that's a big deal to me, actually, Rob, and it's the rereading of books we once read. I spoke a little bit about it a couple of weeks ago. I'd like to talk more about it. Maybe I will in the next hour. That certainly should be one of them. Conscience of a Conservative, 1960, Barry Goldwater. Good point. Good reminder. We'll talk more about it.